This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff, and we are now at episode number 47, a special episode. I am sitting in a hotel room in Austin, Texas. It's 12:30 at night. The American Family Therapy Academy Conference has just come to a close. There was a nice awards banquet. And I'm tired, but I'm also exhilarated because I just went to a great conference, heard a lot of great talks, and was able to do, and I think I let people know this, that we were going to be doing, we had the honor or privilege to present the Radical Therapist or the Radical Roundtable. I was able to come together with my colleagues, Veronica Kuhn and Lauren Foster, and we were able to do a brief presentation on podcasting as a teaching tool, etc. So, and how it's kind of influenced us and what we do. And it was just kind of a great experience to be able to kind of share this medium with folks that are, you know, doing work in the mental health field. And we had a lot of fun doing it. It was great. And if you go to the Radical Therapist Facebook page, you can see some photos from our experience. And I thought those came out nice and give you a little taste of what we're doing. Just go to Facebook at The Radical Therapist and you'll find them. But the AFTA conference was a great experience. If you have not done the American Family Therapy Academy conference, put it on your schedule. Think about it. It's, you know, 2.5 days of some great talks. You know, we started, the keynote was done by Dr. Ana Louise Keating, who we interviewed here on The Radical Therapist. If you go back a little ways, I forget which episode it is, but it's an amazing conversation. You should check it out. And then, you know, that started us off on Thursday night. And then Friday, we had Ruben Parra Cardona and Jean Malpas. And Ruben was talking about the urgent need to embrace advocacy and family therapy practice and preventions and shared lessons learned in parenting prevention research with low-income Latino, Latina immigrants. And Jean Malpas, some of you might know, he's at the Ackerman Institute, and he is one of the founders of the Gender and Family Project at the Ackerman Institute, and he spoke about the otherness from otherness to alliance and how families can and clinicians embrace gender expansiveness. And then we just went on to a great conference, and I was able to moderate a great panel on white accountability, and we had some folks talking about training white therapists about being white and white privilege. What Gene Combs, some of you might know, longtime narrative therapist, presented on white privilege and what can a white family therapist do with it beyond feeling guilty. And it was just on and on and on with some great, and I'm leaving a bunch of wonderful speakers out, but it was just a great event. You can go to the AFTA website to see, get a taste for it. And we're going to be in Oakland. I'm on the planning committee for the next conference. I was on the planning committee for this conference, but we're going to be in Oakland next year, and you should come hang with us. And I think more than anything, I got to hang out with my mentor, my long-term mentor, Dr. Amy Tuttle from Pepperdine University, who will become the president of the American Family Therapy Academy. Just was elected president, so she's president-elect going into this new year, and she's awesome and my mentor, and I got to spend some quality time with her this weekend. It was just wonderful. So anyway, what we're sharing with you tonight, when we did our presentation, we actually recorded it. We had our microphones. I brought my mixer board, packed it on the plane, and we did our presentation. And recorded it. So what you're getting now is our live podcast presentation at the American Family Therapy, the 2018 American Family Therapy Academy Conference. And you're going to, you know, the quality is going to, it's pretty good, but it's not great when we get to the Q&A, but I did the best I could to clean it up so you could hear some of the questions. And so you're going to get a taste of our presentation talking about podcasting. And I also want to give a shout out to all the folks that were there who use the podcast, the Radical Therapist podcast, that put it in their syllabi and have the students listen to it. To all the students who reached out to me at the conference and said, hey, we listen to the podcast. We really enjoy the podcast. I don't know. It's just so special, I think, to be. I'm just for a moment, I just want to tell you, it's just like really amazing that, you know, when this, I didn't know what to expect when I started this thing. And then just to have, you know, these people come out and just say, hey, I use your podcast as a teaching tool, or students saying, I get a lot of value out of your podcast. It helps me participate in conversations I wouldn't otherwise get. It's just wonderful. And then a special shout out to Jessica Moore, who is actually a relationship researcher, but found the podcast and became interested in what we're doing in the family therapy world and came to the conference because she was a listener of the podcast. And Jessica, I want to just give a shout out to you. Thank you for making that trek to doing something kind of risky and then coming out and supporting. It's really special. So kudos to you, Jessica Moore. I hope we, you know, connect again, our paths cross again. And I do want to go to your relationship communication conference. I think you have one of these days. I want to go to that thing. So anyway, so without further ado, this is, it's going to be myself. We're missing Bryson, who's been, those of you that are longtime listeners and have been listening to the Radical Roundtable. Bryson wasn't able to make it out, so we're missing him, but we do have Lauren and we do have Veronica. We have three-fourths of the Radical Roundtable, and so let's go to our presentation. Okay, hi everybody. We're going to be doing this with microphones because we're the podcasting section, and we're going to actually be podcasting this. So is anybody familiar with the Radical Therapist podcast? Anybody? Oh, good. Just going to see some hands, yeah. Okay, so what we thought we would do, and I have the setup here too, so if anybody is interested in starting a podcast, I'd be happy to talk with you after to see, so you could show you how easy it really is, okay? But it's our task today to kind of talk about how this medium, Dr. Mock used the medium of film, and then we're going to talk about how this medium has been... how it's influenced us, how the response we've gotten from an audience. I have a fairly, it's obviously a niche audience, but I have a fairly, it's an international audience. And but before we get started, let's introduce ourselves and maybe locate ourselves too. Sorry about that. My name is Chris Hoff. I am cisgender, heterosexual, white male. I probably am considered class-wise in the 1%, but that's probably because I'm married to a woman who's a VP of a $3 billion tech company, and she's been very successful. And so that's, I think, my location. And
yeah. Hi, everybody. My name is Lauren Foster. I am a black, cisgendered, heterosexual woman. I would say class-wise, I grew up very poor. And so now sort of at the margins of being poor and starting to work my way up and through my own career. So it's a weird sort of liminal space between those two classes.
I'm Veronica Kuhn. I'm faculty at Texas Women's University currently. I am cisgendered, heterosexual, female, mother of two. Today's my daughter's second birthday. She's in Denton, or in Dallas area. And to situate myself in the room also, if that's okay, I'm feeling a lot of rawness today. And vulnerability about a lot of different things. So I want to give some voice to that because we often don't do that in conference presentations. And as part of pulling back the curtain that we do here at the Radical Therapist, I want to acknowledge that.
Yeah, that's good. Can everyone hear that now? Okay, we will talk louder. Okay. Yeah. Well, they're not live. You're not going to hear them, so that's why we're going to... Yeah. Well, no, but you're not going to hear anything through them, so we're recording, but we will do a better job. But, so, the story of how... This is,
three parts of the Radical Roundtable. And this has been a forum where we're all friends and colleagues, mm-hmm. and we would kind of sit around and have these interesting conversations about the field, about social justice, about trying to make a living as a therapist as well. And they were kind of very interesting conversations. And then one of us proposed the idea of, like, it would probably be a good idea to... Maybe that's not a good idea.
Okay.
he tried.
Sorry.
But we thought it would be a good idea to, you know, there's that blank slate metaphor that's kind of weaved through a lot of what we do that's still predominant even in family therapy programs, even though it's based in something pretty far removed from that. But so we thought we would pull the curtain, like mm-hmm. Veronica said, and we would have these conversations. And they've been very, very popular. They're like our most popular podcasts. And I get a ton of emails. The majority of emails I get are from students and programs that are like, wow, you know, I'm in this program. We're not talking about these things. Thank you so much for talking about that and these kinds of things. And maybe my first question to the both of you is like, what has been your experience so far in utilizing podcasts, both as in educators and just as selves of the therapist work, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm.
Lauren and I actually started our academic careers co-teaching internship classes for family therapy students. So we got to watch live videos and teach together. And both of us agreed in an internship class, it felt odd to assign readings because we come to class and we watch videos and we talk about the clinical work. And somehow readings didn't always fit with mm-hmm. what was happening in the room. But we wanted the therapists to stay connected to literature and stay connected to the field of family therapy and mental health issues and the larger society. And one of the ways that we were able to do that was bringing in podcasts. And some of the first podcasts I think we brought in were the Ackerman.
All the Ackerman podcasts. Jean Malpass, or mm-hmm. Malpass, one of his podcasts were one of the mm-hmm. ones that I think was most popular with one of our classes. So it was the podcast Between Pink and Blue. And so we mm-hmm. use that, and I still use that oftentimes, even in teaching more quantitative methods. I use that as a way to sort of talk through some research and how, you know, we can do research in a more sort of socially just type of way.
One of the limitations, though, was, well, what's it like for these people who are talking as experts? What is going on in their internal world? How do they grapple with the struggles of being a family therapist in private practice, or being a practitioner, or experiences of sometimes working in isolation as a practitioner, as an academic, as a researcher, whatever the environment you're in, it can oftentimes feel isolating. Or can I ask that question? Is it faux pas to ask about salary or how much you charge your clients, or how do you think of a fee and also think about relational justice or relational activism? How do I provide for myself while also wanting to provide for those who are in marginalized positions? And nobody was having those conversations, and we were having them in private, and so it really inspired us. The other thing too is when I think about podcasting and assigning it to my students, I don't want it to just be about family therapy. I want it to be about the landscape of the world that they're functioning in, whether that be listening to podcasts that have political ideas or undertones, whether it be podcasts that are about life and self-care, about physician care, about a variety of economic issues. There's a really great podcast from Freakonomics that actually has quite a few family therapy researchers. It's a podcast on the science of sleep. And it's actually really interesting, and it's very research driven, but it's also very familial and systemic in nature. And it challenges our students to think about sleep is not a symptom of a diagnosis. It is that, but it's not just that. It's also an economic issue. And when there's sleep disturbance, when there are societal contexts, the podcast talks about poverty and how that impacts sleep, living in an unsafe neighborhood. It ties in all these different things. And there are so many podcasts that aren't therapy in nature that connect to these larger social contexts that really help our students, I think, from my experience, be able to expand their understanding of systems, not to there's the mom and the partner or the other parent and their child and there's grandparents, but that there's also this whole other world that's interacting at the multiple levels. And I have really enjoyed podcasts for that reason as a way of using them as a teaching tool.
I think even in working with students who don't often get the chance to work with different types of people. So at least where we were, all of the students worked with a very similar population. They're usually very middle class, maybe were of different ethnic minority statuses, but that was about as much diversity as they got to see in practice. So I think even in incorporating podcasts that are outside of sort of the therapeutic realm, students are able to experience and really step into what it could be like to work with this client. So we often brought in podcasts where they were sort of the trans students, right? And so in doing that, we can think of like, okay, so how would you work with this person if they were actually sitting in the room? Let's role play this out right now after we finish listening to this podcast for the class. Because often our students weren't seeing those people in their therapy rooms, right? Even if they were working in community-based settings, they were oftentimes seeing low-income families, maybe of color, but maybe not. So being able to do that and incorporate those different voices inside of the classroom, I also think it's important to note that inside of the classroom, they weren't very ethnically diverse either, right? So it's being able to incorporate these different voices that they're not able to see or experience at a personal level, where we can more oftentimes get that and get those actual voices in the room versus, you know, I'm Black and okay, I'll be the Black person today in the classroom, right? Like that doesn't really work. And then that, in all honesty, puts a lot of work and burden on me as like the ethnic minority in the room to like, okay, not only am I going to be your professor today, but I'm also going to sort of be the stand-in for any Black person that you could come across in terms of therapy, right? So I also think that allows us to incorporate some of these ideas more realistically for our students who may not have the opportunity, and for folks who are in areas where, you know, ethnic diversity, gender expression, it's very limited. I think that's another way to pull those multiple voices in and to pull their actual voices inside of the room.
Yeah, another one of our favorite topics has been, and I think Lauren's influences more than any of us, is the idea of the self of the therapist.
Yeah.
And that work and utilizing this. And I was wondering if you could say some more about that.
Sure. So my master's is from Drexel University. And so as a part of that program, it was required for us all to go through self of the therapist training. So that training is very intensive and it's tough because it is a huge mirror in front of yourself and in front of your cohort and classmates around, you know, who do you see yourself as a person and as a therapist, and what are some signature themes that sort of interweave between those two areas, right? So me coming in as Lauren, as the person, that is going to show up in the therapy room. However I sort of envision myself and see myself in the world, or see other people seeing myself in the world. So I think that even in thinking of podcasts, sometimes that often reflects where I am as a therapist and where I am as a person. So sometimes I will assign things that maybe are more salient to what I'm interested in the moment. So for years now, I've been interested in working with families living in poverty. So that's what I did my dissertation around. That's what mainly all of my work has been around. So I will oftentimes find myself, I teach statistics classes because that's what I like to do. But I oftentimes try to get these ideas around poverty, or trying to dispel myths around who families that live in poverty are, into my classroom, right? And so that's one way that if we're going to talk about stats, I can tell you all of the stats about, you know, families that live in poverty, but that also comes from a place of, this is who I've lived as a person, right? Like I have this personal experience of what it is like to be a child growing up in poverty. But also coming out of, this is what my research has been based in. And the ideas around like families that live in poverty are really quite resilient, and we think of them as sort of the complete opposite of that. So I think that's where a lot of myself as a therapist work has come from and has led to, but it is that sort of cord that ties me to what is it that I want to do, and really how I assign work and podcasts and things of that nature, and sort of how I show up in the world, I think.
Want to say something about that, Veronica?
I was just thinking similar, not about Self of the Therapist, but about podcasting. I mean, Chris mentioned we are, we are somebodies, but we are not podcasting. Anyone can do it, right? And in terms of publishing, getting peer reviewed, if your work gets sent to a peer reviewer who has a strong stance against it, it may not ever get published. And so as Lauren was talking, I was thinking about a podcast that I assign related to statistics about problematic quantitative research, including p-hacking. It's a great podcast from 538, and it's a topic that's not getting talked about enough. But as also a quantitative researcher, I want my students to have a critical idea, critical thoughts about quantitative research and the limitations of it, and not to distort data that may then have implications for marginalized populations, for minority populations, that may overgeneralize things. And so I think podcasting is also a great way to get information that may not be accepted by the dominant discourse of academia. And I was just thinking about, from a self of the researcher, self of the activist perspective, that I'm frequently trying to say, what voices aren't we hearing in the literature, and where can I find those elsewhere? And podcasting, finding podcasts or creating podcasts, has been one way to add some dialogue to those conversations that is really lacking and can really enrich and enhance conversations and expand our capacity for how we understand dominant discourses in the field.
I was just looking for a podcast because Gene Combs in the White Accountability Group also referenced a podcast being very influential in the paper he had written for, I think it was JMFT, and then he expressed the idea that we need to do the work, right? And so how can we do the work? And one of the ways that I've done the work is through podcasting, and it's created a lot of opportunities for me to learn a lot. Like one example would be Pod Save the People, DeRay McKesson's podcast, which is all social justice based. If you're not familiar with it, it's been really, really great from my work, right? And so there's a lot of great opportunities there. I've had a lot of students at this conference, actually. Most of them, yours, I think, Verona, have come up to me, and it's kind of fun. I'm wearing a shirt, so that's cheating, but they say, hey, we know you because your podcast has been assigned to me, and like I said, and I've had, Saliha, you said some that you've, yeah, and that people have done that, and it's just so wonderful that people have listened to it and appreciated it. And Anna Louise Keating came out of I interviewed her on the podcast, and so that became very interesting. So it's something simple like this, like you said, just some friends getting together to have a conversation has created ripples in a way that when we talk about like relational activism or kind of this this interconnectedness that was talked about in the opening keynote, it's really interesting that just some friends that we thought we were having some interesting conversations. We came together and we do this, and then it just has these ripples, and I think that's really, really powerful. Yeah.
I was also thinking from a pedagogy perspective too. A lot of, we met in Southern California, which if no one's ever been in Southern California on the 10 freeway, it is abysmal and you sit there for hours, right? And podcasts are also a really great way. I have a ton of students who commute, and they appreciate when I assign podcasts because they can listen to it on the commute. It's not something that they have to find a book, purchase a book, sit and read for an hour that maybe they don't have. A lot of the students that I work with have families, have full-time jobs. They're very busy, and that's not to say that they're not reading or they shouldn't read, but how else can we, as instructors, accommodate some of our students' needs, like assigning podcasts? They're going to be sitting in the car for an hour, hour and a half, some of my students 3 hours a day. If I can assign a podcast and they can optimize that time, they can sit in traffic, sit on the freeway listening to that, I've gotten feedback that students really appreciate that. And it also means when they show up to class, they have something to talk about because they've listened to it, they've engaged with it, or they put it on and they dozed off, and we get to talk about how not dozed off literally on the wheel, but that we get to talk about what was it that wasn't engaging? What was problematic for you? What what was going on that distracted you? And how does that show up in the therapy room when that happens with a client, right? That all of these are sort of teaching conversations that really expand and invite students who maybe reading a textbook is not the preferred learning method for them.
Okay, so I think we're about out of time. So we'll end there until the questions and the Q&A. So.
What is podcast? Like, how is it defined?
So the question is, what is a podcast? I don't know. Right. I was new to it. A friend of mine had a popular political podcast, and he had done some stuff with Occupy Democrats, and he just talked me into doing a podcast. He was like, you need to do this. So I don't know, but where does it come from, right?
Yeah, but is it something like you get on the internet and you...
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Have you explained that?
Yeah, it's like the radio of the now, right?
So there's different apps. Most iPhones come with the Apple podcast app already there. It's like a purple square with some lines on it. Stitcher, Podbean is another one. You can download these apps.
Spotify. And then
you can download the app, and then you can in there download podcasts. So you can download them directly to your phone. So if you don't have internet or you don't want to use data, you can go on the Wi-Fi, download them, or you can just listen while you drive.
And if you were going to do them, is that a whole other technology to...
Yeah, so then it gets a little more complicated on that end, yeah.
So I had a question about the podcasting. So I think a lot about social media and online communities. Do you have like an online forum for listeners or ways that listeners engage with each other or with you?
Yeah, so we do have social media. We're on Instagram. We have a Facebook page. There's a website and Twitter account. And so we try to make it pretty easy for people to interface with. And they do, yeah. And I think the most, I get a lot through email, actually, right? A lot of conversations, and some of them quite, like looking for counsel or advice or in academia often, you know, or just wanting to, I give away free shirts. I actually have two shirts here if somebody wants a shirt. I have a large and a medium radical therapist shirt if somebody wants them after this is over. But
it's for the person who had the funniest face.
Yeah, right.
We were looking.
I was going to bring more, but I forgot. So people respond, they want shirts or stickers or something, and I'll do that. But so there is interface, and that's the best part about it. Like when you get like an email from, Russia, I had some people that I've made friends from people in Moscow, a narrative community. Some of you might know, where's Jacqueline? Maybe knows Murat and some of these people. But and then they came and stayed in my house, and that was all through the podcast, right? And it was really cool. And I had some family therapists from Moscow staying at my house that we met through the podcast, and that was really cool. Yeah.
Actually, I just posed to Chris before this forum that I'm here because I am a communication researcher who focuses on relationships, but I've begun to study more and more health and wellness, mental health. So I found out I'm a therapist, and he had t-shirts and stickers. And so we engaged in that community. He sent that to me, and we sort of had just one single email exchange, but then also through this podcast, I found out about APTA. And so I came to this conference just as a byproduct of hearing what, you know, marriage and family therapists are doing as opposed to communication researchers. So I think it's pretty positive that the podcast is like inviting people.
Wow, we want to go multidisciplinary. This is great.
So there you see the power. And it's like I got a mixing board and some free software. It was free and a couple mics. And look what happens. And you can just have these kind of, this really kind of neat thing.
And we didn't plant the audience member who just spoke.
You just paid.
Paid her in free shirts.
I'm going to find out what people are doing.
So I guess I'll ask two questions and you can answer one. Because on the self of a therapist, I think most people agree the importance of it, I'm making some assumptions, I guess, that it seems that it's not always taught, or it's expected that people are to know, or either you do it or you don't. And so I guess the question is, why do you think that is? And then if you were to teach it in a more, or how do you teach it?
Sure. So I guess that's my question. So I think that it's not utilized as much because it takes a lot of work and a lot of foresight to do it. So in the program that I was in, it was one of the core pieces of what we did. So not only did we have a year-long class in Self with a Therapist, it was also something that we had to write on in each and every single one of our classes, my entire master's. So it wasn't a one-time, you figure out what your signature theme is, and then that's it, we're done for your entirety of your sort of coursework. It was, we're going to figure out what your signature theme is. We're really going to dig really, really deep and sometimes painfully deep for some folks, and figure out what it is that's happening for you that's coming up and that's going to come up more often than not. And then we're going to integrate it into every single one of our classes. So we had a class on, obviously, like your abuse class. Your Self with a Therapist theme has to come up in one of your assignments there. If it's a class on sort of larger social context, it's going to come up there. So I think that's a part of why it doesn't come up as much, because that takes a lot of planning to do, right? Like, and every single person has to be on board. And I will say the advantage of going to Drexel, and that having, you know, been the case, all of my professors were also trained and had that experience as well. So as a faculty, they all had done Self with a Therapist training themselves. So they all had signature themes. They knew exactly what it is that we were going through as students. And so they were able to grapple with some of those things, hold us if we really needed to do that, hold that space. But again, that takes a lot of planning, because if I'm teaching a stats course, I have to have an assignment where my students can also talk about that Self with a Therapist theme, and also still holding into account, like, we still have to cover this, this, and this over the course of a quarter. So I think that's probably why it isn't covered as much, because that it's hard work. And I saw that on the student end, and now being on the other side of it, like, that is going to take a lot of planning, and you have to get a lot of people on board with this is a core piece of what we're going to do and how we're going to train our students. So I think if I were to do it, I think I have some ideas about how to do that, particularly if we're talking about quantitative methods and getting students to do research that maybe sort of shift more towards their Self with a Therapist sorts of ideas. But again, I think it just takes for an entire department, an entire sort of program to be everybody, every single person from, you know, your folks who are working, your admin, to, you know, your program directors, everybody has to be on board. And I think coming from having that experience, it is very much an experiential thing. And if you haven't gone through it, I think you lose so much of what that experience and how transformative that experience really is.
There are some students that don't buy into it.
Yeah. That's fun. There are definitely some of my classmates who didn't initially buy into it, right? So at one point it was kind of nicknamed the crying class, right? So every week it was like, oh yeah, we're going to the crying class again, whatever, right? Because it is very raw. Like, some people will be more willing to be vulnerable up front, and others are, you know, they're going to be more closed off. But I think because it is something that comes up in literally every single one of your classes, that at some point during that 2-year time span, you're gonna have to deal with this, because you're gonna have to talk about it all the time. And so I think at some point repetition, it gets you. It either gets you at the front or gets you at some point during the process, right? So at least for me, that's how I experienced it. But Veronica also teaches a class where she uses Self with a Therapist.
Yeah, I just wanna add to that, having served in an administrative role, understanding the complexity of not just having an entire department on board, but having the legal counsel of the university on board, and discourses around Self of the Therapist work administered by an instructor can cross over into therapy and be unethical because your student did not consent to treatment, and having to explain that Self of the Therapist work is not therapy, and that it's unethical as an instructor, as a supervisor, if I don't talk about those things with my students, and then they go and enact Self of the Therapist issues or problems in an unethical way to a client, right? It's this bind of, it's unethical, or it's been labeled crossing the line in some ways, and so then having to advocate. And if I'm the only instructor in my program doing this work and none of the other instructors are doing it, then the crying class then becomes the class that I avoid or the class I try to substitute for a different class. And then we have some issues of self-selection, which is great as a teacher because students then come into my class who want to do this work, but then there's also maybe a body of students who pick a different instructor or pick to do a different elective or something like that. And so I think it's a challenging conversation to have. One of the things I noticed being in Southern California, where everybody I think goes to therapy or knows a therapist or,
really.
And then moving to Texas where it was, the discourse of students wasn't, I went to therapy and wanted to help other people in the ways that I was helped, but I feel bad for them and I want to help them, but I don't go to therapy because there's nothing wrong with me. I've heard that several times, that there's this idea that they don't need to do work, which then made the self of the therapist work a bit more challenging in this context of, well, people here don't go to therapy unless they're sick or there's something wrong with them. And so it's really challenging, and it's part of that relational activism of how then do I step in and say, this is important work and I'm going to push you towards this and it's going to be uncomfortable and you may not like it at times, and I'm going to also hold space for those discomforts and also hold space for why this is so important when you're working with the populations you work with.
Okay, that's the show. That was our presentation. That was fun. I hope you enjoyed it. It was a brief presentation, so it did go pretty quick, and I'm sure we could have sat there and talked with the people that came to the presentation, you know, for another few hours. I just love question and answers, and but that's it. So I'm in a hotel room. It's 12:39 at night now. And I'm going to go to bed, and then I'm going to, allegedly I'm getting taken to get the best breakfast tacos in Austin tomorrow morning, and then I'm going to fly home and get back to it. And so I want to thank you all of you out there who listen to The Radical Therapist, who share The Radical Therapist. I want to thank you for that, and I want to thank you for listening. And as always, my name is Chris Hoff. And this has been the Radical Therapist Podcast.